throughout my book, then, The Lost History, is also to bring forth and to show that liberalism has not only been about expressing, safeguarding, protecting, and encouraging individual rights and choices and interests, but it's also been very much about the proper behavior of citizens, these duties, these responsibilities to the common good. And we forget those often. There is so much emphasis on rights and less so, I find, on duties.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Velkommen til Civitas podcast Liberal Halvtime. Jeg heter Mathilde Fasting og dagens vert. Hver tirsdag og hver fredag denne sommeren publiserer vi Liberal Halvtime. På fredag så kan du høre Civitas-samtalen med kollega Eirik Løkke. Den finner du også som video på YouTube og heter Civitas-samtalen. Du kan abonnere på denne samtalen på YouTube, og du må også gjerne rate oss i podcast-appen din. Dette var dagens reklame. I dag så har jeg nemlig med meg historikeren Helena Rosenblatt fra City University of New York. Hun har nylig publisert boken The Lost History of Liberalism from Ancient Rome to the 21st Century. Og den utgangspunktet for samtalen vår. Du kan også lese min anmeldelse av boken på Minerva.net. Denne podcasten tatt opp i starten av juni, og den på engelsk. So, welcome Helena and thanks for coming to the podcast online from New York.
Thank you very much, Matilda. I'm so pleased and honored to be with you.
It's great, and I'll have to ask you in the beginning of June. Life in New York at the moment is gradually coming back to normal, but it has been a challenge for liberalism and for liberal people because actually we had to close down and free movement hasn't been possible for many months. What do you think about that and how does that correspond to liberalism being closed down?
Well, you're so right. It's been very a strange place to live in. It's felt almost surreal with empty streets and closed shops and restaurants, everyone walking around with masks. And also the fear, you know, people were very frightened. I think we're calming down now, but you were hearing ambulances, sirens all the time. And yeah, it was a scary time. People, though, in New York City took the regulations well, you know, they obeyed them in large part, liberal or not liberal. I think they felt that it was necessary to do this for their own protection and the protection of their fellow citizens. So I was almost surprised by how much people really did practice social distancing and wore the masks. They're still wearing the masks. Of course, we're a little bit worried about the demonstrations and whether this is going to cause a peak in infection rates. And we certainly hope not after everything we've done so far and that we seem to be coming through on the other end. But yeah, people have voluntarily been listening to our governor and obeying the rules.
So, because now you're saying actually two things. You have the state is actually put rules to our movement, and that's one thing for the state to do. And in liberal thought, that might be a dispute we could have. And the other thing is demonstrations, which is freedom of speech. But well, then again, if you have rules against demonstrating, that means not for demonstrating, but for being many people together and not respecting the social distancing, that could also be an issue for conflicts.
Yeah, absolutely. There has to be a balance. I think liberal thinkers have known this all along, that yes, individual rights, we respect them, but perhaps in moments of existential danger, there are moments of exception, moments when people have to understand that there's a danger actually to all individuals. And these were voluntary. I mean, the shops had to close down and so on, but I didn't feel that we became a police state or or anything. The police presence was minimal as far as, you know, my own experience was. You know, I didn't see that many police now because of the demonstrations and not because of those so much, not the Black Lives Matter demonstrations so much, but the looting that was going on. And that's, of course, an attack on property and general disorder. And in that case, I think police action is necessary, but it is a balance that we have to strike and understand. And it's a difficult one. I understand the problems that people see in it. And of course, the brutality of the police has been a shock to many, many people. But I think also coming together and protesting, observing social distancing is important and has been permitted.
Yeah, so liberalism in a way is, I called it a buzzword today, and of course also the opposite, illiberalism. And as a historian, you seem to have somehow written a book that is really timely and relevant.
Yeah, I'm very glad that I can provide some perspective, maybe even some lessons for this difficult moment in the history of liberal democracy. When the idea that liberal democracy had won out, so to speak, that it was the end of history, has now apparently been shown to have been wrong, or so it seems, with the rise of illiberal democracies around the world. But of course, you know, I could not have predicted this. I started the book a long time ago, and at that moment, we weren't speaking so much about a crisis of liberalism. I had other reasons to begin to write it.
But you're a historian, so why did you choose this subject?
Well, you know, my first two books were on political theorists, Jean-Jacques Rousseau and then Benjamin Constant. I was interested in a little bit in their connection because Benjamin Constant is, as you know, recognized as now one of the founders of liberalism. And of course, he criticized Rousseau, respectfully, I may say. But I wanted to explore their connection. And as I did that, I began to see that there weren't many history books or any actual substantial history of liberalism on the market. And so I really rose to the challenge, so to speak. I had a lucky coincidence was that an editor came and asked me and told me, hey, we need a history of liberalism and you seem to be the person to do it. So that's really why I got into it. And then the more I looked into it, the more I read around, I realized that there are a lot of contradictions and sort of misunderstandings or disagreements about what liberalism really is. How can it mean one thing in Europe and another thing, or the rest of the world as well, and another thing in America? Why do people assemble different canons of liberal thinkers? Why do they, you know, these kinds of questions really intrigued me. And so I thought, let me try to sort this out.
But you called it the lost history of liberalism. Why the lost?
Because precisely, I think people don't realize what they are calling liberalism is anachronistic. So I went out to try to find the true history of liberalism that has been lost, and some of the one of the originalities I would say is, and one of the things I found out through my conceptual approach was that. It's not an Anglo-American tradition. You know, we hear often that that liberalism is sort of invented or in England. It goes all the way back maybe to Magna Carta. Any canon of great thinkers will include John Locke, Adam Smith, probably John Stuart Mill, and so on. So it's thought of as this Anglo-American tradition, and France, for example, has recently, even when they talk about it, say that, well, it had a liberal tradition, but it was kind of faulty or something wrong with it. And Germany, of course, had no liberal tradition. It was mainly an illiberal country. Well, the lost history shows that this is not the case, that Liberalism, in fact, was the word itself was coined in 1813 or around then, and it was in response to the French Revolution. And for all along the 19th century, it was really thought of as something French. One of the things I noticed was in England and in America, very often when they spoke of liberal, when they used the word liberal in the political sense of the word, they put an E at the end, or they wrote it in italics. You'll see that in newspapers, to indicate its sort of foreignness and the fact that this, you know, it was an idea precisely associated with the French Revolution. And then, sort of, in, you know, the first liberals, the first theorists, and I discussed this as well, were really then Benjamin Constant and Madame de Staël. They were certainly among the first liberal theorists. And they were mainly concerned with establishing constitutional representative monarchy and bringing down the absolute monarchy that was in existence in France and establishing the rule of law, individual rights, checks and balances and such thing, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of association, the church-state separation, and those kinds of things were the original core principles of these liberals. In the middle or towards the end of the 19th century, industrialization was really taking off, and it was becoming clear that there were other problems that liberals needed to face, having to do with industrialization, urbanization, the rise, you know, the terrible conditions of the working class in the cities. And now German ideas started to have an effect on thinkers. German ideas about the role of the state in stepping in and helping workers, factory laws, minimum wages, insurance schemes, all sorts of things where the government should play a larger role. And here then I describe how liberalism was separated into two streams. One that thought that the government should play a larger role, precisely to step in to create conditions that were better for the working class, for the poor, and the other stream, which was laissez-faire, saying no, what we need to do is lessen regulations, further stick to the course, so to speak, and deregulate as much as possible, and that's the way to do it. And so these two streams remain today. You'll see that in America we have the interventionist type. That's what liberalism means in America, and in Europe mostly it means the laissez-faire approach. I'm somewhat simplifying, but yeah, that's what I explain in my book. So that's part of the lost history of liberalism.
That's very interesting, and I know also that you. The title of your book says that you are going back to Rome and to Roman roots. And I thought that part of the book was also really exciting because you took the word liberale, which with the E in the end that you just mentioned. And you mentioned rights and duties and responsibilities. And you also write a lot about morals. What is the history and what did, for instance, Cicero as a Roman thinker think about liberale?
Well, yeah. So taking this new approach to the whole to the subject, to the history of liberalism, I thought that the way to do it really historically accurately, avoiding anachronism, was to look at the meaning of the word. And so I know, you know, we all know that the root of liberal and liberalism is liber. The Latin meaning of that root is freedom. And we frequently hear this, that the root of liberal is freedom. But the other meaning of the word is generosity. So, and liberalitas was a word to describe the noble behavior of a citizen. Yes, freedom, lovingness, but also generosity, commitment to the public good. There were responsibilities involved with being liberal, and it was a kind of an elitist concept because it was the values of a citizen, not a slave. Now, throughout my book, then, The Lost History is also to bring forth and to show that liberalism has not only been about expressing, safeguarding, protecting, and encouraging individual rights and choices and interests, but it's also been very much about the proper behavior of citizens, these duties, these responsibilities to the common good. And we forget those often. There is so much emphasis on rights and less so, I find, on duties.
And those two are actually very important to have, both of them, in order to have a society that functions.
That's correct.
Let's just move on to religion and to the church, because you also write about those oppositions that you had if we go back to the 18th and 19th century and liberalism and Catholicism and all those strains and thoughts you had in Europe, especially at that time. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yes, of course. Now, I mentioned earlier that that liberalism really came together as a constellation of ideas, a family of concepts, if you will, as a result of the French Revolution. And that one of the, and this France is, of course, predominantly a overwhelmingly Catholic country at the time, where you had something that people refer to as the throne and altar alliance, where the Catholic Church gave tremendous support to the monarchy. The king was called the most Christian king, and there was really a close collaboration there to maintain the status quo, the aristocratic monarchical order based on hereditary privilege. So when the liberals attacked this notion and supported instead, promoted separation of church and state and freedom of thought and freedom of religion, this was perceived as an attack on the church. And then I should immediately emphasize not only the church's Catholic Church and the Pope in particular and his spokesman hostility, therefore, to liberalism from the very beginning, all the way through the 19th century, calling it a poison. I mean, the words are unbelievable. We talked today about the incivility of political debate, but just have a look at the history. It was a poison. It was satanic. It was demonic. It was, you know, all sorts of things. But I need to slip in there the fact, and not such a little fact, but, you know, those of you who have studied the French Revolution know about the most radical phase, which was that of the terror, the one that's famous for the guillotine and so on. And there was a terrible de-Christianization campaign at that time. We call it that. There was the Civil War and the de-Christianization a campaign which really, you know, vandalized churches, humiliated priests. It was a lot of attacks. And the Pope and the church is very much on defensive and turned against what they call liberalism. They blamed it on liberalism, this terror. Liberals, of course, always said that was not what they intended. That was not at all what they were for. But this really stuck and the Catholic Church was hostile to liberal principles from then on until, you know, into the 20th century, basically. And not just the Catholic Church. I don't want to suggest that all Catholics were illiberal or anything like that. It's just because there were plenty of Catholics in France and elsewhere who actually also approved of and supported liberal principles of government. But there were these Orthodox Protestants as well who were upset with what was going on, did not like freedom of thought, freedom of religion, and therefore anathemized liberalism.
Yeah, and then the France ended up by becoming, at least for a period of time with Napoleon, the election of what you called an authoritarian leader. So how could that come about? The liberals wanted another form of government.
Well, they did, but you know, in the beginning, most of them collaborated with Napoleon. There was a tremendous, you know, I mentioned the Civil War. Liberals were up against tremendous odds, counter-revolutionaries, royalists, there were demonstrations. The place was, France was a mess, and it was very hard to stabilize. So you had something called the Directory, and the Directory had a really hard time stabilizing the situation, saving the accomplishments of the liberal period of the revolution, by which I mean civic equality, constitutional representative government, and basically the rule of law. There were plenty of counter-revolutionaries who want to bring back the absolute monarchy, undo all of these accomplishments. And so Napoleon came along and was this general who had conquered Italy and was terribly popular. And a lot of liberals thought he will save the revolution. He's a good guy.
It took a time then until France became what we could call a liberal democracy. But bringing it up to that, because actually liberal democracy is not a very ancient formulation or ancient term in any way, but it's we have coined the two words liberal and democracy, and I will ask you, are there any contradictions between these two terms, and how can you explain liberal democracy?
Well, that's a great question, because today very many people, you know, use that term unproblematically, liberal democracy, and they're not. They don't naturally go together. Liberals were hostile to democracy for a very long time. They were certainly not in favor of it. They were opposed to it. And why is that? Democracy, by the way, hadn't really been, you know, they're not thinking about representative democracy. It really means people power. And liberals saw the action of the crowds during the French Revolution, and they thought they were irrational, they were uneducated, they didn't have the mindset, if you will, to make good decisions for themselves. So liberals were really anti-democratic. Under Napoleon, by the way, under Napoleon, you had universal male suffrage, so a kind of democracy, if you will, but he ruled by plebiscite and then dismantled all the protections and all the liberal principles that they had fought so hard for, and yet he remained popular. So liberals would have thought that the term liberal democracy is almost like a contradiction in terms. When it came about, when the term was coined later in the century, around 1860, I think, it meant really a democracy that had been tempered or educated, kind of tamed.
It's important because you put education into, an enlightenment, if you will, in general. And what does that have to do with these questions?
Well, yeah, going back all the way again to Rome, you had liberal arts education, right? It was regarded as absolutely essential for citizens to be educated in the principles of their government, in virtue, what it means to be a good citizen. And this was very important part of the liberal principles throughout history, that citizenship required critical thinking. You get that really in the Enlightenment with Kant, sapere aude, dare to think. And many of these liberal leaders and theorists and thinkers believed that you needed a certain amount of enlightenment in order to make decisions that were good for everyone, to think beyond your private interests. And to be enlightened, you needed some property, they thought. That's also a reason why they had the property requirement and weren't Democrats, because they thought that you needed the leisure time to educate yourself and to think in a broad-minded way.
So one of the things that often is said is that you have, in order for countries to become liberal democracies, if we still want to use that those two words together, they will say that it takes a certain level of education, and you also take, of course, a level of economic welfare and economic prosperity in order to have the fundament for having a liberal democracy. How do you see that?
You mean, do I agree with that?
I think we probably agree, but is there any, do you think you could have a liberal democracy without having an educated, a certain level of education in societies?
No, I don't. I think that as 19th century liberals saw with demagogues and would-be dictators and dictators like Napoleon the Third, Bismarck, again and again, they saw that uneducated people are susceptible to demagoguery, that these demagogues and dictators can come and cater to the electorate's worst instincts, the people's fears, irrational fears, use propaganda to convince them of things, to actually favor things that are not in their interest. So I think that we're seeing that around the world today. And one of the core problems, I believe, is a lack of education.
So when we're talking about illiberal democracies like Hungary, where Orbán calls, he uses that term on his own country, and I cannot talk to someone in New York without mentioning the United States. And of course, you have an education level that's high, but you also have elected a person that's probably not very liberal.
Yes. Absolutely. This is very disconcerting to us. People who are leaders who are democratically elected, and when they get into power, they start dismantling the protections that are so important for to maintain a liberal democracy. The rule of law is threatened. Judicial independence, the freedom of the press. We unfortunately have this problem in America as well. Perhaps not as bad yet as in Hungary, but we also see these techniques of demagoguery, of what we call now populism, of sort of appealing directly to the public in a way that suggests you represent them sort of directly. We don't need a stalemate parliaments. We don't need politicians. Just listen to me. I'll make America great again. I can do everything on my own. Or I'm your true leader. These are unfortunately things we're observing around the world today. And it would not have surprised 19th century liberals, right? This would not have surprised them at all. They'd seen similar things. And, you know, liberalism, as I think I said earlier, or I meant to suggest, was very much designed or invented, if you will, in reaction to this kind of problem, precisely to stop governments from falling prey to dictators, to prevent another Napoleon.
Now that's an important remark, because of course then you should read, or I should have the listeners read, of course, your book, because it's called The Lost History of Liberalism, and apparently people should know about the history because it's important. But you briefly mentioned in the beginning the American-British concept of liberalism and the continental European one. And are there any other differences than the laissez-faire and the intervention of state that you see between them?
I think that's the main one. I've been noticing that in other words, the European and the American liberalisms, the differences between them, they do have to do with this issue of colloquially big government versus small government. Yes, that's a key thing. But what I find really super interesting, when I was in Belgium and Holland and Sweden this summer, I was reading up and hearing about liberalism there, and how you can talk about social liberalism, and how you can talk about liberal socialism there, as if that's not a contradiction, as if liberalism can be socialized in this way. And in America, you know, they are so frightened of this word socialism. They're, in fact, liberals in America have been shying away from the word liberal for a long time, because, you know, since Reagan.
Yes.
So
they call it progressive.
Yeah, they want to be called progressive, they're moderate. I don't know, you know, what they want to be called, but very nervous even about calling liberal and socialism. My goodness, just Bernie Sanders was in big trouble because of that, right?
How would you describe or how would you define then social liberalism or liberal socialism? Well, maybe the first one's better.
Which one did you say first?
Yeah, well,
I see them kind of
the liberal or social liberalism is probably
better. I think
better.
It's social liberalism. Yes, a liberalism that is not the extreme libertarian neoliberal type of liberalism, but one that is favorable to some government support and intervention. So it's something in between, I would say, a liberalism of the what is called a 19th century. Variety and social democracy, but you know these barriers are they're it's fluid and they're not very strong. I think the differences here.
But if you're drawing, or if we're taking another term there, this neoliberalism, which is also another form of liberalism and opposed to, or the differences between that and classical liberalism, what would you say then? What are the differences?
Well, you know, from my perspective in America, looking at the way neoliberalism is used predominantly, it's really become like an insult word. You know, it just seems to mean to us, very sloppily used, by the way, something to denigrate those who believe in deregulation of the economy and such thing, such moves. That's what neoliberalism has become, it seems to me. Although there are many attempts now by scholars to clarify and explain. Classical liberalism really it harkens back to the 19th century. Those like libertarians in America, they call themselves libertarians, really say that they're classical liberals. They're looking back to the 19th century saying, we are the true heirs to Adam Smith. And so it was. It came about, it's come about in a very different context. I would say neoliberalism is more of a 20th century invention. Classical liberalism is a kind of a way of, you know, I don't really think it's accurate to say that libertarians today who call themselves classical liberals really are true to 19th century liberalism, because 19th century liberalism is not exactly what they take it to be. But nevertheless, classical liberalism at least claims to be true to 19th century liberalism. Neoliberalism seems to be something that is a more recent invention and can, for example, be partnered with dictatorships like in Latin America and so on. So it's got like a really bad name. I don't know anyone who says I'm a neoliberal. Am I wrong?
No, you're right. I think it's only a term that you use to describe others. Yes. So I think it's even here in Norway, I think that's the case. So, but what are the lessons learned today for today, you think? Why should we read the lost history of liberalism and be interested in liberalism as such?
Well, thank you for that question. I think that maybe the first reason to read the book is to for this clarification of what really liberalism is, what it has meant, how it has evolved over time, so that when we use the word, we're at least aware of what definition we are using, so that we can have good conversations with one another, conversations that go somewhere where we're not talking past each other. Besides the things that we've spoken about today, I would that you can learn from my book about the Anglo-American tradition and so forth. Understanding that America alone is not responsible for liberalism, but that many countries have contributed to it, and that it's a very fragile thing. I think that's a lesson we get. It's been up against formidable enemies since the very beginning. Liberalism you know, encountered formidable enemies from the very beginning, had to fight hard throughout the 19th century, experienced reversals and regressions and kept fighting. It's not something, you know, we hear of the march of history. We hear that it's sort of as if it were an inevitable thing, that it should just grow and grow and spread almost effortlessly because it's so so obviously reasonable and true. Well, that's simply not the case. It's been a kind of a fighting faith from the very beginning. And I think we can take pride in its history and learn that we have to fight for its survival.
So, yeah, that brings me over to my next question, really, asking you if you think these liberal values and liberalism will survive the corona pandemic, because this is, if you are talking about fighting, this is a fight.
It sure is, and I mean that's the big question, and I can't, as a historian, promise that I have the answer. I'm more comfortable with the past than with the future, but I would say yes. Again, liberalism has passed through so many crises in the past. It's and they have each time has had a setback, but has managed to come back, reinvent itself. I think this is also a key. Liberals have, in general, been pragmatists, right? This is also something that we lose if we just think of a canon of great thinkers, of great philosophers of liberalism. But if we look at what was happening on the ground, who were the liberals who were fighting for policy, for laws? They were practical people, and they adapted to circumstances. And as circumstances changed, they adapted what they stood for. Maintaining those core values of freedom and generosity, but understanding that you have to sometimes reinvent yourself, reconceptualize yourself. And I think that's probably what's going to have to happen at this crucial moment in history.
Yeah, because we actually are. It's 2020 now as we're talking in June. So, and finally, as a historian, I just have to ask you, what are your next projects?
Well, my major project that I'm just starting, I'm very excited about, is an intellectual biography of Madame de Staël. Little is known about her. She's known more as a great novelist, but she was an early liberal. I hope to restore her to a rightful place as a founder of liberalism. We know more about her partner, Benjamin Constant, much more. They were a intellectual power couple, I would say, but the emphasis has always been on him. And I believe that it's time to really examine her contribution. And this will actually, I believe, change a little bit our understanding of liberalism as well when we bring her into the picture. And she was so well known at the time. I mean, Napoleon was just so frightened of her that he had to exile her repeatedly. She herself was a powerhouse. She's mentioned in many texts and newspapers. She had many of Benjamin Constant's ideas before he did, or at the same time. And so I would really like to, and I'd like to write a readable book, you know, for a larger public, and not just an academic book. This is what I enjoy doing at the moment, trying to, at this moment also of a crisis in the humanities, and a crisis in the teaching of history, at least in America, where history departments are closing down in universities. I think it's more important than ever to show the public why history matters, why big ideas matter, why we need to know where we come from. And so I'd like to write that sort of book, a book with a kind of public that my last book had, The Lost History of Liberalism.
Thank you so much for joining me today, Helena. I do fully agree, as an historian myself, this is really an exciting project. And it was really a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
Takk for at du hørte på dagens episode, og hvis du liker Liberal Halvtime, så kan du gjerne abonnere på sendingene våre I podcast-appen din, og selvfølgelig gjerne rate oss. Vil du holde deg oppdatert om hva vi gjør I Civita, så kan du abonnere på nyhetsbrevet vårt. Da går du bare inn på www.civita.no og legger inn navn og e-post. Takk for I dag, og velkommen tilbake.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita. Yeah.